And thank you very much for waiting. I really do appreciate it. I'm just not used to driving in Michigan winter weather yet, literally. I just got through a car, Ford Lightning, as a matter of fact. And we left Detroit 2 hours ago. It was supposed to take about half an hour to get here, and it was under normal circumstances it would have. But I very much appreciate your patience, and I'll try to give you a full lecture anyway. I suppose at least some of you have the same trouble getting in than I did, so maybe starting tonight wouldn't be too bad. It could be worse. On Mars, it snows dry ice. And I've never known to do that even in Michigan, although there are times when I wonder. Tell you what, could we have the lights out, please, and get started right away? The slide you've been looking at for the last few minutes is a diagram of, just a listing of the major areas of investigation in Viking. And the thing that I don't think most people realize about Viking is how enormously complex it was. It is, I should say, because it's still definitely going on, probably will be for many years. The news coverage had a tendency to talk about one area only, and that, of course, is an extremely important one, the search for life on Mars. But important though that is, that was only one of 13 major investigations, which together make up the most complex unmanned space mission that has ever been flown by anybody for anything. And Viking has a complexity that is staggering even by the standards of previous space technology. I could go on for a long time about just the real miracle of an engineering achievement that it was to build a Viking lander, but I think you'll get that sort of by osmosis simply as I tell you what the results were. This is by no means a listing of all the experiments. This is simply the major areas of investigation. And in fact, at that, they managed to leave one out. There is the inorganic chemistry as well as organic, which is listed down here. Inorganic chemistry is studying what the soil itself is made of. You've got four spacecraft. There are two orbiters and two landers. All of them are in excellent condition at present. In fact, so excellent that a question that people often ask me, namely, how long do you think Viking will go on, is one that there's simply no easy way to answer. There is no obvious factor which is going to limit any of the four spacecrafts in any reasonably foreseeable time period. And so probably what will happen is when they do begin to fail, they will do so piecemeal. You'll lose maybe one experiment now and another one a year later, another one 6 months after that, and so on. And it wouldn't surprise me in the least to be getting at least some data from at least some of the spacecraft, in the 1980s. You know, this thing is just going to go on and on. The ALSEP instruments left on the moon by the astronauts are another example of the same sort of thing. They were designed to operate for 1 year apiece. And the Apollo 12 ALSEP, which was set up in November 1969, is still half operative. You know, so this guy is still sending back very useful data. And in fact, it has turned out that if the ALSEPs had lasted only as long as they were supposed to, we would not have gotten as valuable information as we did. A lot of the real goodies came in long after their design lifetimes were exceeded. Wouldn't surprise me in the least if anything were true of the Vikings. Let's try to bring you up to date as to where we are in the mission. There was a period of a bit more than a month there in November and December when Mars was behind the sun as seen from Earth, and therefore we were out of contact with the spacecraft. They were not, as was widely misreported in the media, turned off. The spacecraft were operating, at least two landers were operating, and taking data at not the full rate, about one-tenth the rate at which they're capable, but they had to store all the data on the tape recorders. The thing was that since we were out of contact with the spacecraft, and the reason for that is that when it's directly behind the sun, as seen from Earth, you would have to send radio signals back and forth between Earth and the spacecraft through the atmosphere of the sun. And the atmosphere of the sun, of course, is very, very hot and emits a lot of radio emission of its own. And there is so much natural radio static produced by this process that it would simply drown out your communications. There's no way that you could get data back reliably. There's no way you could send a command up and expect the spacecraft to understand it and so forth. Signals were sent back and forth containing no information, simply to study the effects on those signals of not only the atmosphere but the gravitational field of the sun. So this is just one example of something that is really incredible. You see over and over in Viking how they use absolutely everything. You know the bit about in Chicago they use every part of the city except the squeal. Well, in Viking they literally use the squeal as well. There are about a dozen major investigations on Viking, independent investigations on Viking, simply using the character of the radio signal to tell you one thing or another about Mars, the interplanetary environment, the Earth, and even in the case of this thing where they pass behind the Sun, the nature of gravity all over the universe. And you may have heard that the preliminary results from that gravity experiment are in. The data were so good they were able to get preliminary findings months earlier than anybody really expected. And so far, they are in very good agreement with the predictions of the general theory of relativity, which is their best existing current theory of gravity. Okay, so there's a lot to fight. Well, what happened during the early stages was only the very beginning. They tried to get as much as possible done before conjunction. That's the name for that period when they were behind the Sun. Because there was always a possibility something might go wrong in one of the spacecraft, and if so, of course, there wouldn't be a thing you could do about it from Earth. You probably wouldn't even know about it from Earth. So they wanted to get as much as possible done. But there was every reason to suspect that, in fact, the spacecraft would survive conjunction, and indeed they did very well. And so now what we have is what is called the extended mission. There are very severe budget constraints which are affecting Viking and have all along. For example, when Lander 2 touched down, Lander 1 was 90% turned off, in the sense that it began taking data at only 10% the rate which it was capable of, and that was back last September. The reason for that being not anything that was wrong with the spacecraft, but something simply that was wrong with the budget. There was not enough money to get data from both spacecraft at the maximum rate at which they could send them. And so, simply for that reason, this beautiful spacecraft was simply 90% thrown away as soon as the other one touched down. Now they're in even more reduced data mode, again, for budgetary reasons. They were forced to cut back the number of personnel who are operating the spacecraft from the ground, getting the data, to about 20% of what we had last summer. And so material is really kind of coming in a trickle, and they're quite severely limited as to the flexibility that they have. If something happens that wasn't expected, what changes they can make, say, in the orbit of a spacecraft. There's a good example, which is going on currently. It'd be nice if they could change the orbit of Viking orbiter too, but they simply haven't at the moment for particular reasons that weren't foreseen, and it turns out they haven't got the personnel to do it. The limited personnel have to do other things that are even higher priority. But at least in a trickle, the extended mission is likely to go on for quite a number of years. Okay, my own relation to Viking, I guess I should explain before we go any further. I run the planetarium at the University of Michigan. I give lectures all across the United States, of which this is an example, and I've given these Viking lectures a number of other places and will. I'm an itinerant astronomy popularizer, basically. And I've always been annoyed at the way the news media covers space, which is to ignore 90% of what happens and get the other 10% wrong. And that is certainly what they did, like in general. And I finally had a chance to put my mouth where my money was, or something like that. I had done a number of reports for National Public Radio in the past, and they had liked them. And I decided that I was going to get out there and be there for Viking when it was happening last summer, because I simply couldn't imagine spending the summer of 1976 anywhere else. And so to give you an example of what something like landing on Mars will do to the true space freak, in order to get there to California, the Jet Propulsion Laboratory for Viking, I learned to drive at the age of 33. I had never done so before because I never had a reason to. 2 weeks after getting my first license, I bought my first car. 4 days after delivery, I drove into California. And so the real title of this series of lectures is How I Spent My Summer Vacation. There you see the car and myself and Death Valley, where we stopped in on the way back to see some Martian geology. Of course, your overwhelming impression of Death Valley is the heat, which you don't have on Mars, but as close as you can get in North America to Mars is probably Death Valley, and I'll show you a few pictures that I took there later on. The car is a white rabbit, as in Alice in Wonderland, and you just barely see the Viking insignia up there on the side, and I'm happy to report it got me there, and it got me back, and even got me here tonight, although a little bit more forward than I could have hoped. Well, in any case, while I was there, I was able to report it for National Public Radio, and what I was able to do, basically, was tell them, look, I'm going to be there anyway. You've got me for free, basically. You may as well take advantage of it. And as it turned out, they took far more coverage than either they or I had expected, because I think that I actually did something that I had never really dared to hope would happen. That is, I really managed to talk a news medium into believing that they weren't covering space as well as they should. And so the end result was, I think NPR covered Viking more than all the other networks put together, and at least there's one news medium that, well, they didn't do a decent job, at least it wasn't their fault. The news coverage in general, however, I think it is safe to say was pretty lousy, and by the end of this evening, and certainly by the end of the five lectures, I think you'll begin to see that. Final thing to say before we get started, that is, let's get the cost thing out of the way and over with now at the beginning, and then be able to talk about the science, which is the interesting part. This is a bar chart which I prepared a number of years ago now, as you can see. In fact, it's 5 years out of date, and I suppose if I weren't so lazy, I'd have redone it by this time. But 72 was a reasonably good typical year, a recent year, and in fact, if I redid it now, it would make my point even a little better, because all the numbers have gone up except space, which has gone down. 72 was the year, as it so happened, when we had both the greatest single year's expenditure for Skylab and the most expensive Apollo flight, and so that was the main reason why it is this particular year. Okay, now the point of this is simply to make arithmetic comparisons. And whenever I show this bar chart, I find that if I don't explain that, I get somebody mad at me because they think I'm editorializing against the money we spend on welfare or something like that. I'm not. That's not, you know, what you came here to hear me talk about. Besides, I wouldn't dream of saying anything against welfare. If the space budget goes down any further, all the astronomers are going to be on welfare. So, you know, I certainly wouldn't criticize it in public. What I want to point out, though, is this. The length of this line right here, the length of that red bar, is the cost of the, not just Viking or not just Apollo, but the entire space program in that year. And here is the amount of money that we spent on government health, labor, and welfare programs in the same year. And if you want to add in education, you can add the length of that bar as well. And so the people who believe or profess to believe, and I suppose, you know, they're sincere about it, that you could solve all of our social problems by simply taking these enormous amounts of money that we spend on space and adding it to the trickle that we grudgingly give out to human needs, are apparently just completely ignorant of the arithmetic. I really wish that it were that simple. You know, I know how badly the space program has been hurt by all the many, many budget cuts that have been going on for year after year after year. I'd really like to think that it was alleviating starvation or something as a result. Unfortunately, I'm not allowed that delusion. I know the numbers too well. I also wanted to put in the amount of money that we spend on defense, because you constantly hear the phrase space and defense. Right? As though they had something to do with one another. Well, in fact, we spend about 30 times as much on defense as we do on space. And, you know, again, it's really comparing apples and oranges. And besides, I would venture to suggest, and that's the point of these bars in here, that the whole argument about whether we should spend money on space or social programs, you know, the whole either-or mentality, is irrelevant. Any country that can afford this kind of expenditure, I claim, can afford both. In fact, there's more to it than this. These are expenditures only, and most of these monies are in fact expenditures. We don't get anything particularly back for them. But the most recent study on the economic effect of space expenditures concluded that for every $1 billion you spend on NASA, you get $14 billion back into the economy simply as a result of the spin-off. That is the value to the economy of the new technology developed as accidental byproducts of solving all the tens of thousands of engineering problems you have to solve in order to do something like landing on Mars. So in fact, the honest cost for Viking is not the $1 billion figure that was quoted so commonly and with no context, you know, in one news story after another all through the summer. The honest figure is minus $13 billion. That's the minus sign indicating that's how much profit we make out of it. And so if somebody asks me, do I think that it is justified to spend money on something which gets $13 billion clear profit back into the economy, some of which at least could be presumably used for human needs in a world in which people are starving, I can but answer yes, you know. I mean, I don't really see what other answer you could give. That $1 billion, to give you an idea of how much money it does represent, in the first place, something I never told you, it was spread over 8 fiscal years. It's not as though one day we went out and decided to dump $1 billion into the ocean.
and it was spread, of course, over 210 million or thereabouts American citizens. And so the average cost to each of us per year for Viking, which was the most expensive unmanned space project ever flown, most of them are cheaper than this, and in fact Viking is the only one I know of that actually costs more than some of the manned projects have, the average cost to each of us per year for Viking was about 60 cents, or about half as much as we spent on chewing gum during the same period. Now, what I find really incredible is that this notion that space is so horribly expensive and something we can't afford is so widespread. I mean, it's essentially part of the culture. When any time for the last 15 years, anybody who cared to spend 10 minutes in research in the library could have found out these numbers. And I think that it's really a criticism of the news media that they haven't found this out for us and pointed out, surely one of their functions is to debunk common myths. But anyway, I trust that covers the cost situation. Let's get on to the science, which is the part that's really interesting. What I'm going to do is give you five lectures, of which basically the first two are going to be on the solid body of Mars, the middle one is going to be on the atmosphere, and the last two are going to be on the biology or the chemistry, whichever you happen to believe is going on. Whatever it is, there is something really, really strange, really different from anything we've ever seen on Earth going on Mars. It is either life of a sort that we have never had any idea could exist. For example, it can operate in the essentially complete absence of liquid water, or there is non-living chemistry of a sort that we literally had no idea could happen. And so one way or another, the biology experiments have discovered something extremely important. What it is, we simply don't know at this point. And so I want to talk about the other aspects first for at least three reasons. Number one, to show you that they do in fact exist. Number two, to show you that there is already a lot that we know for sure about Mars, because the problem with the biology is that I just have to keep telling you over and over again, well, here are the data, but we don't know what the interpretations are. We don't yet know the answer to the question, is there life on Mars? All I can say is every time we try to find out something more, it becomes more bizarre, and it's just really an incredible situation up there. But also, number three, because if I tell you the environment of Mars first, then you will have some appreciation of what it is that living things have to put up with if, in fact, they do exist there. So, for all those reasons, I wanted to go through the geology to start off with. And anyway, the geology gives me a chance to show you all kinds of incredible pictures, and here is a good example of one of them. This is a picture of Mars taken early in the Viking 1 mission by Viking Orbiter 1, and it shows a portion of the southern hemisphere of Mars. Both of the landings were in the northern hemisphere, which was having summer. As a matter of fact, the summer solstice, the first day of summer, was, by coincidence, July 4th, the bicentennial, which in turn, by coincidence, was the original target date for the first landing. And believe it or not, that was a coincidence. I don't know if you're aware of the fact that the whole thing about landing on July 4th was not a political stunt. By one of the coincidences so incredible that they happen only in real life, July 4th, 1976, really, honestly was the best date to land the first spacecraft in this particular mission. And, well, the first week anyway, you know, picking that date was a political stunt in that sense, but picking that week really was not. And we actually did lose a little, not a whole lot, but a little, by having to delay the landing until July 20th. Of course, if we hadn't delayed the landing, we would have lost a lot more than that, we would have lost the spacecraft. Nevertheless, it was summer in the northern hemisphere, and that was one of the reasons they landed in the northern hemisphere, because, after all, if you're looking for life, presumably the best time to look for it is in the summer. Well, this is the opposite hemisphere, therefore. This is winter, and you can see that, in fact, except for the very, very foreground here, which is the northernmost part, you're looking south in this picture, except for the very foreground, the whole ground there is covered by snow. It is deep inside the big craters, it's shallow in between the craters, but there's snow everywhere. Well, we can see that snow even through telescopes from Earth. And we know that it is snow, that it's not a permanent ice cap like the one in Antarctica, because you can see that it disappears almost entirely in the Martian spring and summer, and yet in the Martian winter it comes from the pole all the way down to about the same latitude as southern Michigan here on Earth. And that in itself is very Earth-like, because we have a snow cap that appears on Earth in the lands every winter, and as you know, as you can certainly tell today, it comes down to about this latitude. So we had thought for a long time that Mars was very much like the Earth, that it had an Earth-like climate, because after all, we know what snow is, it's frozen water, and it melted in the spring and irrigated the deserts, and if there was life there, the water could be used by that life, and so forth and so on. It was not until 1969,
when Mariner 7 flew over the South Pole during the winter and measured the temperature for the first time in history, that we found out the truth. The temperature down there was 190 below zero Fahrenheit. That snow is not frozen water, it is frozen carbon dioxide. It's dry ice. Now, where does all that dry ice come from on a planet where, so far as we know, there are not millions of dry ice machines turning it out everywhere? The answer is the air on Mars is very, very thin. It averages only half of 1% as thick as the air that you're breathing right now at the surface of the Earth, which means that even if it were pure oxygen, there wouldn't be enough of it for you to breathe. But it is not pure oxygen. It is, in fact, almost pure carbon dioxide. 95% carbon dioxide, in fact, I can tell you from the Viking figures. And so what I'm telling you is that it gets so cold on Mars, not everywhere, mind you, don't take this as typical, but at the coldest place, namely the polar region, at the coldest time of the year, namely the winter, that the air freezes solid and falls on the ground. And a third of the Martian atmosphere is tied up in that polar cap every winter. In the spring, when it evaporates, notice I don't say melt, dry ice is dry. When you heat it above the freezing point, it turns directly into a vapor. It does not go through a liquid stage on the way. And so in the spring, it evaporates, and you get enormous amounts of gas being released back into the air, and you have winds of 200 to 300 miles an hour coming off the polar caps for 2 Earth months running. And of course, while one polar cap is evaporating because it's spring, the other one is forming because it's autumn. In fact, that is going on in the northern hemisphere of Mars right now. The autumnal equinox, the beginning of autumn, was January 4th Earth date. And so what I'm telling you is that every year, twice per Martian year, one third of the entire planet's atmosphere goes shuttling back and forth from one pole to another, freezing solid and falling on the ground and evaporating out. And what you are seeing here is midwinter, and this is about the maximum extent of the polar cap, and you can look at that and realize that it is quite an impressive phenomenon, which even in southern Michigan we do not see. Okay, the other interesting thing about this picture is the underlying topography, which obviously is craters. Now, we know that those impact craters are very ancient. One of the biggest shocks from the Apollo lunar studies is the craters have not been forming steadily through geologic time. Instead, almost all of them, 95%, had formed in the first billion years of the solar system's 4.5 billion year history. The Earth, the Moon, Mars, the Sun, the whole solar system were 4.6 billion years old. And by the time it was 3.5 billion years ago, 95% of the big craters in the Moon had already formed. The same sort of thing is presumably true on Mars. I don't guarantee the numbers are exactly the same. You're closer to the asteroid belt there where some of the meteoroids came from and so forth. Nevertheless, these craters that you're seeing are very ancient, 3-4 billion years old, something like that. And you don't see them in the northern hemisphere. The northern hemisphere of Mars is so different from the southern that it's almost as though somebody had taken two completely different planets, cut them apart, and glued them back together again the wrong way. The northern hemisphere is almost craterless. And it is mostly covered by a gigantic sheet of dark basaltic lava. Millions of square miles of lava, which came out of the inside of Mars and took hundreds of millions of years, perhaps more, to flow out until finally it had covered almost the entire northern hemisphere of Mars, actually about 40% of the planet. I don't want you to get the idea the boundary is exactly the equator at knife sharp, you know, but it's irregular and there are places where there are craters even at 40 degrees north. But most of the northern hemisphere is this great basaltic lava sheet. Basalt is a kind of lava that is very common throughout the interstellar system. There are hundreds of thousands, if not millions of square miles of it on the Earth, the Moon, probably Venus, and certainly Mercury, as well as Mars. You have seen the basalt lava sheets on the Moon. They are the dark areas that make up the face of the man in the Moon. They're the areas the news media insisted on calling the seas during Apollo, which of course is a silly name. There are no seas on the Moon, except that there are seas of frozen lava. And those lava sheets are flat because the lava was liquid, and they are heavy. The basaltic lava is quite a dense material, and so the northern hemisphere of Mars is on the average depressed 2 miles below the southern hemisphere. Therefore, the air pressure at the ground in the northern hemisphere is higher, and that was another reason the northern hemisphere was chosen for the Viking landings. Number one, higher air pressure is more likely for life, for reasons that I'll get into later. And number two, the parachutes need a lot of air to work, and so they wanted an area where there was lots of air pressure. And so for all those reasons, they landed in the northern hemisphere at the beginning of summer. Earth has lava sheets too, these basaltic lava sheets. The bottoms of our oceans are basaltic lava sheets, and 3/4 of the surface area of Earth is covered by them. Also, there are smaller ones up on the continents, which can still be hundreds of thousands of square miles. For example, almost the entire southern third of Idaho and about half of the states of Washington and Oregon are one gigantic basaltic lava sheet, the Columbia River Plateau and Snake River Plain, which, again, it took several hundred million years, several tens of millions of years to come out of the inside of the ground, and did so rather quietly. There aren't a whole lot of volcanoes up there. This is not the kind of lava that forms a lot of volcanoes, although, as you'll see, there are some very impressive exceptions to that statement. But generally, this stuff flows out of the inside very quietly and simply spreads out laterally for hundreds of miles before it finally solidifies, and so it forms these big flat sheets. Well, that lava buried the craters in the northern hemisphere of Mars, and relatively few meteorites have hit in the northern hemisphere since. So if you want to see the really old terrain, the pre-lava terrain, you've got to go to the southern hemisphere where the lava never came out. When you do so, you find that some of these craters are absolutely gigantic. This, for example, is about half of the second biggest crater on Mars, the Argyre Basin. And that is one single crater produced in an individual meteorite impact 800 miles across. That is the distance from here to the Gulf of Mexico. The explosion that formed that crater when the meteorite hit was equivalent to 3/4 of a trillion Hiroshima-sized atom bombs, which is somewhat more than you would have if you had been making 10 atom bombs a second, 24 hours a day, 365 days a year, since the birth of Christ. That is the second biggest crater on Mars. The biggest crater on Mars, the Hellas Basin, which I'm not showing you because until very recently we haven't had as good pictures of it, we just got back a really spectacular Viking Orbiter 1 mosaic of Hellas, and a month from now I'll be able to show it to you. In fact, I may be able to show you that picture by the end of this series. I'll just stick it in out of context and say, remember I talked about this the first night, because it's really nice. That is 1,200 miles across. That is the distance from the northern tip of Minnesota to the southern tip of Texas. And that explosion was somewhere between 2 and 3 trillion Hiroshima bombs and very nearly knocked Mars apart. If the Hellas impact had been 10% bigger, Mars would not be there today. So we're not going to be talking very much about the southern hemisphere of Mars for obvious reasons. The landers landed elsewhere. I wanted to start off by telling you just a little bit about it, though, so you'd realize it has its interest as well. One more thing I want to point out, and that is the haze layer over there on the horizon. We'll come back to that when I talk about the atmosphere. Now, here's a picture taken in the northern hemisphere of Mars of one of the craters that do exist there, and this lava bedrock there is part of Vastitas Borealis, which is the name for that great lava sheet. This crater is huge. It is only 18 miles across, which means the explosion that produced that was only about 500 million Hiroshima bombs, a real tiny one. And I'm sure that when this picture flashed on the screen, the first reaction of most of you was it looked exactly like the moon. However, if you know the moon really well, in fact it does not, and that's what's interesting about it, that's why I wanted to show you the picture. This thing around the crater, which looks like some sort of giant mud splash, is the ejecta blanket of Eute, somewhat eroded here by wind on Mars, but still quite visible. And the ejecta blanket is the material thrown out from the crater when the explosion occurred, when the meteorite hit. Well, ejecta blankets surround craters on the moon too, but nobody has ever seen one that has this kind of lobate mud splash shape. And after a good deal of study, the geologists have concluded that your first naive impression that it looks like a giant mud splash, in this particular case, really probably is correct. And that the reason that it looks that way, that you never see that on the moon, is that there was a great deal of water in the ground where the meteorite hit. Not water in the liquid state as it is on Earth, where you have a water table, at least in humid areas like Michigan, and you can drill down into the Earth and find liquid water, and that's how a well operates. Rather, what you have under Mars is ice. In other words, Mars is an entire planet
because these craters are seen all over the planet, craters with this kind of ejecta blanket pattern. This is a planet which is largely or entirely underlain by permafrost, permanently frozen ice, which occupies all of the space between the soil grains in the same way you have in the Arctic and Antarctic regions of the Earth. As a matter of fact, you may not be aware that a full third of the land area on Earth is underlain by permafrost, and so actually there's nothing terribly spectacular about that. But what it means is this. One of the great mysteries of Mars, which I'll come back to, is evidence that in the past there have been enormous amounts of liquid water on the planet. And yet, Mars today is a planet where not so much as a drop of liquid water can exist over most of the globe. The reason for that is that the air pressure of Mars is so low. As I say, it's only about half of 1% as great as it is here on the Earth, on the average. There are low areas where it's higher and high areas where it's lower. But on the average, it's 6.1 millibars. And the average air pressure at the surface of the Earth is just about 1,000 millibars. Well, you need an air pressure that is higher than that in order to have liquid water. And if you don't have that, well, everybody knows that if you go up in the mountains, it's hard to boil an egg, right? Because water boils at a lower temperature at a higher altitude. And the reason for that is there's less air pressure. Here is the water trying to escape from the pan. It's trying to turn into a gas and fly out into the air. And the air pressure is literally holding it back down there in the pan. If you relieve the air pressure, if you make it less, then the water is going to be able to get out more easily. In other words, you don't have to supply as high a temperature and it'll boil. Well, you don't have to get up to a very high altitude in the atmosphere of the Earth, about 12 miles up, higher than any mountain, but still planes fly there all the time. And you find a place where the boiling temperature has come all the way down to the freezing temperature. In other words, 32 degrees Fahrenheit. So that at any temperature below 32, water is frozen, and at any temperature above that, water is a vapor. It behaves the same way as carbon dioxide does, even on Earth, let alone on Mars. That is, it can be either a solid or a vapor, but not a liquid. And yet, there is evidence that there have been large amounts of liquid water on Mars in the past, and I'll show it to you. So the question is, where did that liquid water go? How was it stored? And it looks as though the answer is it is stored in the form of gigantic amounts of ice, which is now buried in the Martian soil. And that is reasonable, because the average temperature through the year at any point on Mars, even the equator, even the warmest regions, as soon as you get down in the soil, the average temperature is below the freezing point of water. And so if you get water down there in any state, liquid, gas, whatever, it'll freeze out and it will not come back. And you don't have to get very far down in the Martian soil before you get to a level where the average temperature is the way the temperature always is. There is no daily variation. There is no seasonal variation. Soil is a very, very good insulator. And you've seen that even on Earth. Everybody's probably been to a cave at one time or another where they always told you the temperature is exactly the same all year round. You know, it's exactly 57.3 degrees Fahrenheit or whatever the number is. And it doesn't vary. And the reason for that is that after you get under a few hundred feet of soil on the Earth, the soil is such a good insulator, there's absolutely no temperature variation. As a matter of fact, I'll tell you something that's totally irrelevant to Mars, but kind of neat. There are a few caves known, none of them open to the public, unfortunately, which are so deep, this has to be thousands of feet deep, that in the very lowest recesses, the temperature in those caves is a little bit below the average yearly temperature at that particular place on the ground above right now. These are caves which have taken so long, because they're so far down, to re-equilibrate that they have not yet completely recovered from the last ice age. And so you see on Mars, where there's less air to carry heat away, the soil is an even better insulator, and so all you've got to worry about is the average yearly temperature, and I repeat that at every place on Mars, that is below the freezing point of water, so there is a very efficient cold trap for water operating under the Martian surface. And here we seem to see what happens when a meteorite comes along, you have one of these gigantic explosions, of course all the water at that place boils, and apparently all that steam lubricates the ejecta blanket, so you have this kind of pattern which you never see on the moon where there is no water whatsoever in any form. Not solid, not liquid, not gas, not even water of hydration. Okay, here we are in the northern hemisphere of Mars, the Mosaic Viking Orbiter 1 pictures. Mostly there are clouds, and there are large areas in the northern hemisphere where in the summer there is more or less perpetual cloud cover. And so I cannot tell you something, I cannot show you something I'll just have to ask you to take on faith, namely that if you could see under those clouds, you would see simply huge flat sheets of basaltic lava with virtually no craters in them. However, here, sticking up through the clouds, is the greatest mountain that has ever been seen on any planet anywhere in the solar system, Olympus Mons. It is a volcano, a basaltic volcano. It is the place where lots of the lava and Vesuvius Borealis came from. It is one single mountain bigger than the entire state of Arizona, 320 miles across. And its height, measured, of course, not from sea level, there is none on Mars, but measured from the bottom to the top, is something like 15 miles, three times as high as Mount Everest, the highest mountain on Earth. There are four volcanoes almost this big. Olympus Mons is the very biggest, but there are three others not much smaller in the same general region of the northern hemisphere of Mars, which is called Tharsis. And you'll notice the crater up there at the top, that's not a meteorite crater. It's asking a little bit too much of a meteorite to be smart enough to score a direct hit on the exact top of the highest mountain on Mars, particularly since it's a crater that looks like that on top of the other three volcanoes as well. Those are collapsed calderas. What's happened there is that so much lava has come out of the inside of Mars and produced that volcano that eventually a hole was left underground so big that the entire top of the mountain collapsed down into it. And that kind of thing happens all the time on Earth. There's a nice collapsed caldera on top of the nearest analog on Earth to Olympus Mons, Mauna Kea, in Hawaii, any of the Hawaiian volcanoes. The collapsed caldera here, however, is 50 miles across from one side to the other. And there is one on another of the four big volcanoes, Arcia Mons, which is 75 miles across. That's the biggest collapsed caldera that is known. Notice, in fact, that the clouds cut out at a certain height, about two-thirds of the way up the mountain. The reason for that is that is the bottom of the Martian stratosphere. These mountains are so high that their tops are forever beyond the reach of weather. You could climb into the Martian stratosphere by simply walking up the side of Olympus Mons, and you can see that wouldn't be terribly difficult. It's a high mountain, but it's also very, very wide, and it's not sloped very much. And so you could ride a bicycle up that without very much trouble, except that locally the lava flows would probably be a little too rough for that. But you know, still, in theory, it would be a hike, not a mountain climb in the usual sense. People I know are often bothered by the idea of Mars, which after all is a smaller planet than Earth, it's only half the size of Earth, having bigger mountains. As a matter of fact, it turns out that you actually expect that if you think about it for a bit. You could not have a mountain the size of Olympus Mons on Earth, which is a bigger planet, and therefore is heavier, and therefore has a stronger gravity. Rock only has a certain amount of strength. And if you pile up that much rock on the Earth, the rock at the base would literally be unable to hold the weight of the overlying material. It would flow like molasses and move out to the side. And in fact, the highest you can pile rock on Earth without it failing, in other words, the highest mountain you can have on our planet, is only 7 miles high. And indeed, the highest mountain on Earth, measured not from sea level in arbitrary datum, but measured from base to peak, is 7 miles high. It's Mauna Kea in Hawaii, the biggest of the Hawaiian volcanoes. It's just that you never think of it as being the highest mountain on Earth because most of it is underwater. But nevertheless, both Mars and the Earth have on the mountains which are as high as they possibly can. In other words, both of them are quite active planets geologically. The Earth is more so than Mars, but Mars has at least some mountains that are as high as you can manage because on Mars the gravity is only a third as strong as on Earth. Therefore, you can pile rock up three times as high before it's reached the same weight, and therefore, a mountain on Mars could be 21 miles high. Well, this is 15 miles high, but it's also sitting on top of a great blister in the planet's crust called the Tharsis Dome, which is another 6 miles high. Add that together and you get 21, and that's just the number I told you. Here is a beautiful picture taken by Viking 1 on the way in, and you can see sticking up through the sea of reddish dust and haze, which covers so much of Mars in the summer. Notice there's the summer hemisphere, and there's the winter hemisphere down the south, which is much clearer, and there, in fact, is the Argyre Basin again, full of snow, the big crater that I showed you before. Well, here, sticking up through that sea of reddish dust and haze, are the tops of Olympus Mons and the other three Tharsis Montes. This one is Arcia Mons there, the one with the big collapsed caldera, and this one is Football Mons, and this one is Australis Mons. This is the famous ground fog, which was discovered by Viking 1 on the way in, and indicates that little though the amount of water vapor in the Martian atmosphere is, what little of it there is often very strongly concentrated towards the surface, right where a hypothetical living thing could need it, could get at it. And it actually can be 100% humidity on Mars. It was shocking. We think of it as a desert planet, but it ain't necessarily so. There's a place where the humidity is 100%. Here are pictures taken by Viking Orbiter 1 of the other three volcanoes. There is Skræðis Mons, the one of the northern ones. There is Pavonis Mons, the middle one. And there is Arcia Mons with the Great Collapse caldera. The most recent piece of information about Arcia Mons is that apparently the entire eastern half of it, about eastern third of it, at some time in the past, broke off from the rest of the mountain and went skidding across the plain to the east, forming an enormous debris flow about 300 miles long, which can be traced all that distance. To the south of Arcia Mons, you can trace across the plain lava flows, one after another, produced by the volcano itself, and it turns out that they get younger and younger as you get closer and closer to the volcano, because they have fewer and fewer meteorite craters on them, and that's a criterion for telling the relative age of rocks on a planetary surface like this. The fewer meteorites that have had a chance to hit them, the younger they are. And the amount, the range of ages that you see, the range of number of meteorite craters that you see there is so great that it appears to have taken Arcia Mons at least 1 billion years to form, to build itself up into the enormous volcano that it is today. Here is a portion of the greatest canyon that has ever been seen anywhere in the solar system. By now, I think you begin to get the idea that Martian geology goes in for outsizes. All right? This is Volley Marineris, named for Mariner 9, which discovered it 5 years ago. And Mariner 9 was the spacecraft that taught us most of what we knew about Mars before the Vikings. And in fact, our notions of Mars before Mariner 9 turn out to be so different from the real planet that they are essentially science fiction. We did not even appreciate how little we knew. We thought we understood it better than we did. And there are no canals, and there is not all the amount of air they thought, and the snow is not made of frozen water, and so forth and so on. And so any book on Mars that you have that's more than 5 years old, you know, just don't even bother to read it, except it may be of interest for historical reasons. Volley Marineris is supposed to be Mariner Valleys. It doesn't. Astronomers, I like to think we're nice people, but we are not exactly notorious for our classical scholarship. It was not until after the name had been given and it was too late to do anything about it that somebody finally pointed out that Valles Marineris in Latin does not mean Mariner Valleys, it means Marinated Valleys. Unfortunately, by then the name was official, so we're kind of stuck with it. Well, by whatever name, Valles Marineris is the biggest canyon that has ever been seen. It averages 75 miles across from one side to the other. In other words, the Grand Canyon in Arizona is about the size of that little tributary canyon down there. It averages half as deep as Mount Everest is high. You're not seeing the floor in this picture because most of the canyon system is full of fog, which very often is. And its length, measured from one end to the other, you're seeing about the western half of it in this picture, the length of the entire thing from one end to the other is greater than the distance across the United States, 2,500 miles. We found out from the Vikings what caused it. It was dug by the wind. Mars has given geologists a chance to see something that they have never been able to see on the Earth, and that is large-scale landscapes formed predominantly by wind. On Earth, liquid water is so commonplace, and it is such a powerful erosive agent, that even in the driest regions of the southwestern American deserts, the landforms are predominantly sculptured either by the cloudbursts, which are infrequent but very effective, or even further back than that, by the Great Lakes, which existed in many of those valleys during the Ice Ages. For example, there was no ice down there, but the climate was different, and even Death Valley had a lake in it that was 90 miles long. Like Manly. So we've just never had a chance to see what landscapes formed by wind look like on the Earth. And on Mars, we have finally had a chance to do this. Here is the beginning of the process, and this is the only part that wasn't directly related to the wind. This is a map of about the western third of the equatorial region of Mars, latitude 65 degrees north of the top, 65 degrees south there. Viking Lander 1 site is just out of the picture over here to the right. Here are Olympus Mons and the three Tharsis Montes. Here is something that I didn't mention explicitly, but I'm sure you noticed. It's a great triangular region where the crust is just totally broken up. It's called Labyrinthus Noctis, and it itself is about 500 miles across from one edge to the other. And then here is the enormous stretch of Valles Marineris going out of the picture. What I want to draw your attention to is the contour lines, which form this bullseye pattern all through this area of Mars. And if you're not aware of a contour map, you know that a bullseye pattern like that is a dome. This is, in fact, a gigantic blister in the planet's crust, 2,000 miles in diameter, which is half the diameter of the planet itself, and 6 miles high, and 6 miles higher in the top, which you notice is right there where the crust is broken up, not by coincidence, than it is out at the edges. It's called the Tharsis Dome because it is centered in the Tharsis region where the great mountains are. In fact, you can see these volcanoes, enormous though they are simply small pimples on the side of this great blister in the planet's crust. We don't know what formed the planet, the Tharsis Dome in detail, but obviously the outline is that at some time in the Martian past, probably at least several billion years ago, probably went on for a long time, large amounts of molten rock were drawn together in this region of Mars, and they congregated and they pushed up this great blister, and in fact, in a few places, they came out of the surface and formed a huge volcano. In the back, you're going to have trouble seeing this, so the people sitting up front, maybe you can see that there is one, and there is one, here's a long one, there is one. We've got a set of them up in through here, we've got a set of them over there, we've got a set of them over here, we have a set down in here, and so forth. These cracks are hundreds of miles in length, and they average maybe half a mile across. And they were simply formed by the uplift of the Tharsis Dome. Well, apparently, Valles Marineris started out as one of those cracks. It was the only one that was running exactly east-west. And that is the direction of the prevailing winds in that particular part of Mars. That may or may not be the reason that Valles Marineris was the only one of those cracks which got enlarged into this gigantic structure that you have now. Valles Marineris, for one thing, is so long that it stretches a quarter of the way around the Martian equator, which means that when one end of it is having noon, the other end at the same moment is having sunrise or sunset, which means that there are always temperature differences between the two ends of the canyon, which means that there is a built-in wind generator in the canyon itself. And you have these winds which go whistling along the length of the canyon, changing direction twice per Martian day. In addition, there are the global winds, particularly those in the great global dust storms, which I haven't even told you about so far. I told you about local winds along Valles Marineris and coming off the polar cap and evaporate. In addition, at another time in the Martian year, namely the period just after Mars is closest to the Sun, and the next of those will be coming up at the end of April over its date, there is a global dust storm where you have winds of 300, 400, even 500 miles an hour over the entire surface of a globe half the size of Earth for 4 Earth months. And much or all of the planet is covered by swirling yellow veils of dust raised 30 miles high in the atmosphere by these gigantic winds. And that, in fact, is a very powerful erosive agent, as you can imagine. We saw one of them in 1971-72 because Mariner 9 arrived just as one of them was well underway and was able to show us about the second half of that great dust storm. In fact, after there was nothing else because it couldn't do the mapping of planetary surface features that it was sent to do until the dust had finally settled. Indeed, today, 5 years later, that dust is still in the process of settling. And it is still some of that dust from the great dust storm that is one of the contributors to those incredible pink skies that you're seeing in the photographs taken by the landers in the surface. Well, in any case, all of these winds are blowing in the east-west direction in this particular part of Mars. Now, here is the second part of the story, and this is a Skylab photograph on Earth. I have to tell you what a cap rock is. A cap rock is a situation where you've got a series of strata, you know, layers of rock, one on top of another, and one of those layers happens to be more resistant to erosion than anything else. In the case of Mars, we're talking about wind erosion. In the case of Earth, we're normally talking about water erosion. And so what happens is erosion levels it down to the cap rock and then stops, and the cap rock protects whatever is underneath it. However, no stratum can go on forever. Somewhere you are going to have a break in it. For example, one of these great cracks on Mars. On Earth, the breaks are very often river valleys or they may be faults. And erosion does not ordinarily operate very effectively by sandpapering down the planet from the top. Where erosion, either on Earth or Mars, either by water or wind, gets really effective is where it can find a break in the planet's crust, and then it can get into this wound and attack it from the side and enlarge it. And so you understand that those flat top mesas that you see in Arizona, where you have some cap rock up on the top, but somehow it got broken and the erosion has started eating in from the breaks on the side, and now very often it's eaten away much more than it's left, and so there is a mesa isolated with the top of it seemingly unaffected by erosion, and yet the sides are so obviously been eaten away. Cap rocks can be found over very large areas, and this one is so huge that it takes a Skylab photograph to show it to you. So there's the city of Lubbock, Texas. The west is in that direction. And one side of this picture is about 100 miles. So you've got about 100 miles squared, or 10,000 square miles. And all of this that you're seeing is the cap rock surface, which forms the high plains, which cover 300,000 square miles of the Earth's surface in the panhandle of Texas all the way up into Nebraska. The edge of the cap rock is this irregular surface, is this irregular line here where the rivers are eating back into it. And they form these canyons up into the side of it, the most spectacular of which is just south of the picture that I'm showing you here. It's Palogero Canyon. If you go to Palogero Canyon, where you can see the edge of the cap rock surface, you can get an idea of what the whole sequence of strata looks like. This particular cap rock is not the same kind as you have on Mars, where it's probably some lava. This particular cap rock is a rather interesting one. It's called Caliche. C-A-L-I-C-H-E. And what it is a deposit that is found very often, although usually not in such massive areas as here, in desert areas on the Earth, where water, liquid water, percolates through the rocks, particularly the rock limestone, which is a very common with the surface of the Earth, and is made of a substance called calcium carbonate. And in fact, water can dissolve calcium carbonate even out of rocks that are not made of it, because calcium carbonate is atoms that are very common in rocks, even in other arrangements. And when the water reaches the surface, it evaporates and leaves behind some calcium carbonate. You've seen that happen if you ever live in a hard water area on Earth. The same thing will happen inside your plumbing, you know, and it leaves behind these horrible deposits of calcium carbonate. Well, this caliche is very, very firm in an area where there's a little rainfall, if it were in Michigan, you'd never see it because it would have been washed away, it's dissolved in water. But here, it is firm and it forms the high plane surfaces. And there is a sample. I'm sorry that it's so badly underexposed, but I think you can see the main idea. It is just unbelievable, incredible, monotonous flatness for hundreds of thousands of square miles without anything at all to break the monotony. And you stand there, and this is 120 degrees from one side to the other. I took it with a pseudo fisheye lens. And you stand there, at least my reaction as a traveler, who didn't have to live in this place, was that the monotony itself was impressive. I talked to a lady who lived there, and she said she didn't feel that way. She was just impressed by the monotony. In any case, that is what a cap rock can do at the top. Now, here is what the whole thing looks like at the side. There is a massive Caliche cap rock, and then here we're looking down into Palogero Canyon with one after another of the softer layers of, in this case, sedimentary strata underneath. All right, back to Mars. Here is a mosaic taken by Viking Orbiter 1 of a portion of Valles Marineris, where the canyon is about 1 mile deep. And you can see that inside of the canyon, there is a sequence of strata. And that itself is a very exciting discovery. Those strata might be volcanic. They might, however, be sedimentary, which would mean they were deposited by wind or maybe even by water at some time in the Martian past. And we have learned most of what we know about the history of Earth by studying sedimentary strata. If we can do the same thing on Mars, that is going to be absolutely tremendous, a real gift from nature, which we had no right to expect. You don't have that kind of thing on the moon, for example. But what I want to show you now is that the uppermost of those strata, I think you need to get a hint of that from the picture, is quite hard, quite resistant. I notice how very flat its surface is. That's a lava surface, by the way. There's no question that particular cap rock is a lava. What's underneath, we don't know, but it's obviously softer. The winds go whistling back and forth down the canyon, and carrying material with them, they eat away at the sides of the canyon, until eventually you have a place where, of course, what they're eating away is predominantly the softer strata underneath, not the cap rock, until eventually you have a place where a section of cap rock, the size of a typical Michigan county, has broken off because so much of it had been undermined that it could not support its own weight. And it's gone thundering down the mile into the bottom of the canyon, carrying with it a lot of the softer material underneath, until the whole thing has spread out as this enormous debris avalanche 30 miles long. And you can see islands of the cap rock, which still is not broken up very much. It's broken up into these chunks, floating like icebergs in a sea of softer debris under it. You can see them sitting there, and then you can see the softer stuff, which is all spread out. Now, that itself is not the story of how the canyon formed, because if that was all there was to it, the canyon would simply fill up with its own debris, and you'd never see it as a canyon. Something now has got to remove this material after it has been made soft and vulnerable, and what does that is, again, the wind. You can see here these streaks, which were made by wind blowing up and down the canyon. And you can see that this debris avalanche is only the most recent of a whole series of them all up and down the sides of the canyon. For example, it is resting on this older one, where that section of the wall had fallen off. And here is yet another one. And here are remnants of a very old one, where most of the soft material has been carried away, but the cap rock islands are still there. They're eroded, they're rounded now, but they're still stubbornly preserving themselves, and only bit by bit on the outside are these large chunks of cap rock being broken down by the wind into smaller particles that we can carry away. The wind does carry away this softer material. The very finest material, which makes up the majority of it, is the dust. And the wind simply picks that up, and dust particles are so light that on Mars, the winds are capable of picking them up and not letting them drop back to the ground. How about the larger particles, though? For example, sand. Sand, I don't know if you're aware of the technical term in geology, it refers to particles of a particular size. Smaller than that, you call it silt, or I'm just saying dust. Larger than that, you call them pebbles and cobbles and so forth. Sand happens to be a very interesting size on Mars. It is a kamikaze grain size. Sand particles are just the ones that are not so big that the wind can't pick them up at all, and they can be removed from the canyon only by being wind eroded down into something smaller the wind can be picked up, and yet not so small like the dust grains that the wind can pick them up and not let them back. Sand particles are constantly being picked up and dropped, picked up and dropped, picked up and dropped. And what that means is, every time they get dropped, they hit against other sand particles and they chip. In other words, they turn themselves into dust particles, which the wind can then carry away. And so sand doesn't last very long on Mars. Here is a place where the wind, traveling up and down the canyon, has picked up some sand from some landslides and collected it into a dune field, 30 miles long, made of dunes 400 to 500 feet high and half a mile from crest to crest. And we have seen other places in the canyon where these dune fields are being blown by the wind completely up the side of the canyon, a mile or 2 miles or 3 miles to the surface, and actually being blown out onto the plateau above. But the great majority of the sand never makes it to the top. It is broken down into dust first. And that is the major source of the dust which causes the pink skies on Mars. It comes from only a few erosion sites where there is a crack in the side of the planet that the erosion can get at, and in fact, Valles Marineris is probably the most important one. That, however, is not the end of the story of Martian dust. I'm telling you the story in such length because it has implications far beyond Valles Marineris itself. It turns out to be a major theme in the whole geologic scheme on Mars. The dust does not get carried forever and ever by the wind. Sooner or later, a given dust grain, which is picked up by the wind and carried at random all over the face of the planet, sooner or later, by statistical accident, that dust grain is going to happen to end up at one of the polar regions at the time when the winter polar cap is forming, when the air in which the dust is suspended is being sucked down under the ground like a vacuum cleaner because it is freezing and falling onto the ground. The dust, naturally, is trapped with it. And once the dust gets down onto the ground, it is cemented in place by the water vapor, which was also in the air, and of course freezes when it reaches the surface of the poles, and does not even unfreeze again in the Martian summer. Of course, the dust is also cemented by the frozen carbon dioxide, but that will go away again in the spring and summer. In the spring and summer, however, there is still the ice. And so you have covering 500,000 cubic miles at the two Martian poles, enormous deposits of strata of ice mixed with dust, which are called the Martian polar layer deposits and are responsible for some of the most beautiful photographs taken by the burden, and taken by Marion too, for that matter. This particular place is in the residual polar cap, the one that stays even through the summer, because it's made of frozen water. Yet it's a little frozen water polar cap with two poles. Not the big frozen carbon dioxide one, but here there's an edge to it because there happens to be a canyon to be eroded by wind down in here, and so the canyon again is allowing us to see the sequence of strata. You know, geologists are always big on being able to see a cross-section through the ground, and so when you're talking about geology, you show off the places where there happen to be cross-sections through the ground. Road cuts are great on Earth. On Mars, you don't have that, so you've got to find a place where there's been some erosion. Okay, so here we have a place where there has been. There's the edge of the ice, and then you have a 1,600-foot-high cliff, which is made, which is eroded into the sedimentary deposits, and there's one after another, and you notice they are remarkably regular in size and spacing. Each one is about 160 feet thick. And then finally you have the lowland down here, which is dark since it is in full light. These black dots, by the way, you'll see in all the lighting pictures, they're not on the surface of Mars. Those are on the television camera itself, and they're there to make sure there's been no distortion as the picture was transmitted back 200 million miles from Mars to the Earth. All right, even that is not the whole story. This thing, by the way, about there being a final resting ground, an elephant burial ground for dust on Mars, may sound kind of strange, but in fact we have such a thing on Earth as well. There is a place on Earth where dust can end up and get trapped and never be able to escape, and that is the bottoms of our oceans. And we have seen weather satellite photographs, for example, from the terrible Sahelian drought that is going on now in the south of the Sahara in Africa. You have these gigantic dust storms, and the prevailing winds there are over the Atlantic Ocean. They go west, and you can see these great dust clouds which can travel as far as North America. But normally, they don't make it. Normally, the dust grains, a given dust grain happens to end up at the surface of the ocean. All it's got to do is get kissed by one wave, and it's captured. It's going to fall down to the bottom of the ocean, and there are millions of square miles of the floors of the oceans that are carpeted with dust, which got trapped there in exactly the same way. So what happens on Earth, because of that incredible phenomenon found on no other planet, the oceans of liquid water, happens on Mars because of that incredible phenomenon found on no other planet, the way the air freezes solid and falls on the ground in the winter. And here you are seeing the result of it. But even that is not the entire story. These deposits are strata. In other words, there must have been some sort of cyclic mechanism which deposited now a lot of dust and now less and less and less and less and less, and then all of a sudden a lot of dust again and then less and less and less and less and less, or else you would not see these individual layers. All you see would be one uniform, homogeneous looking cliff. Furthermore, and so that is the first piece of evidence that I happen to have shown you, although not the first discovered, that there has been cycles in the Martian climate, that there have been times in the past when things on Mars meteorologically were very, very different from the way they are now. And that is an extremely important finding having to do with the possibility of life on Mars, and so I'll come back to that. What I want to point out now, though, is that there are cycles on top of cycles. There are big ones as well as little ones. There have been times in the past when, cyclically or not, at least there was deposition going on when these polar layer deposits were being laid down. Now, however, clearly, they're being eroded. Or else we wouldn't see this beautiful cross-section. I wouldn't have this picture to show you. All we'd see would be the uppermost surface of the very top one, and we wouldn't even know they were down there at this stage in our knowledge of Mars. They are being eroded by the winds that come off the polar caps when the polar caps evaporate, when the carbon dioxide polar caps evaporate in the spring. And so once upon a time there was deposition of dust that way, now there's predominantly erosion of dust that way, and so again we see cycles. This one, big one. Long-term ones. Where does the eroded material go? Why, it forms into some of the greatest dunes that have ever been seen. In fact, the entire North Polar region of Mars, we don't know as much about the South Polar region, that may be true there also, but the whole North Polar region of Mars is surrounded about 80 degrees north latitude by the greatest sand dune field that has ever been seen in the solar system. Hundreds of thousands of square miles of enormous sand dunes, of which here you're seeing a especially spectacular example in Borealis Chasma, one of the deepest of the canyons that have been cut into the polar layer deposits. And this dune-forming material is blown south, and remember what happens to sand on Mars. You don't see sand dunes unless they are of recent origin. And so this material, which started out as dust, got cemented together by frozen water into bigger chunks, and now is being, which are sand grain size, and now is being formed into dunes and therefore broken back down again into smaller chunks, broken back down into dust. That gets picked up from the sand dunes and carried south, where it covers about half. Oh, sorry, I got a bunch of sand dune pictures to show you. Well, you see, there's some very beautiful sand dunes which extend for very great distances. In fact, for more than 50 miles without a break in some cases. And you can see some vague circular forms in these pictures as though there were craters down there that have been almost but not totally buried by the dune deposits. At the edges of the sand dune deposits, naturally they tend to break up. Here's a place where you have some nice long transverse dunes like the ones that I showed you. They've broken into individual isolated dunes. And here is yet another place where that's happened, where there's another little salt, namely there are craters here which apparently are unburied enough that they are able to anchor some of the dunes downwind of them, and thereby prevent them from being buried quite as rapidly. And here, for those of you who are into geology, I haven't got time to explain everything I'm showing you here, but for those of you who are into geology, these are barkans. We found them on Mars as well. The parabolic crescent-shaped dunes, which are so familiar and so beautiful in certain desert areas on Earth. Well, this material, after it is removed from the dunes and blown still further south, is deposited over about half of the northern hemisphere of Mars, at least, and probably the southern hemisphere as well, as what is referred to as the polar mantling deposits. And those are called that because they bury craters. You see how funny and pimply this all looks in here. And this is material that has been deposited by wind, buried craters under this mantle of wind-blown material. Now, have you got that whole complicated picture? We take material from erosion sites on Mars all over the planet, such as Valles Marineris. We carry it in the air for years until finally it ends up at one of the poles. It gets deposited there to form the polar layer deposits. The polar layer deposits are re-eroded to form dunes. The dunes are broken down into dust again, and the dust is deposited by the winds off the evaporating polar caps, which of course gets weaker as they go away from the polar caps, into this great polar mantling deposit, which covers the hemisphere around the pole and peters out at a feather edge about halfway down, somewhere around 45 degrees latitude. What all that means is that if you land on one of the polar mantling deposits, you can sample material which has been brought to that one place from all over the surface of Mars. You can study the average Mars at a single location, and X marks the spot, the target landing site for Viking Lander 2. Now you know why one of the two landing sites was chosen. I just want to show you the pictures of Valles Marineris very briefly with minimal commentary. It's got to be the most photogenic feature on Mars. An absolutely spectacular object. By the way, you should understand that this picture, and especially the one that I just showed you, there is so much dust in the air on Mars that you would not see this spectacular detail with your eye if you were hanging there in space next to the spacecraft looking down at Mars. You would see a blurry, hazy, almost featureless planet, and the very strongest shadow you would just barely be able to see at the place directly under you where you're looking through the minimal thickness of air. These pictures have been contrast enhanced by a factor of several hundred. And it's like turning up the contrast all the way on your television set and then multiplying that by a factor of 10 or 100. These are very, very exaggerated in contrast compared to what you'd see. That's necessary, of course, the only way you can see anything. But you should be aware that linear-looking clarity that you see on photographs like this of Mars is very misleading. In fact, it is quite a dusty planet, especially in the summer. In the winter hemisphere, you don't have this problem nearly as much. There's not nearly as much dust in the air because it's colder, there's not as much energy available to create winds, and therefore there's not as much dust, especially the big particles that are carried in the air. You say, wait a minute, it can't be that simple. I mean, it's not that simple in Michigan. We have our strongest winds in the winter. That's true. Martian meteorology, as we'll get to in lecture 3, although it's bizarre by Earth standards, is in many respects simple. It's actually easy to understand in some respects. Nice color picture taken by Viking 1 on the way in. You can see how very much more dust and haze there is in the air in the northern hemisphere, which in this case was the summer hemisphere, than there was down there in the winter hemisphere. There again, by the way, is the Argyre Basin full of snow. It's amazing how many good pictures we got of that. And here is Valles Marineris, the western half, and the eastern half too, but full of fog, so it's a little bit harder to make out. Now, here is probably the most incredible kind of geologic feature that's been discovered on Mars yet. I've heard that Mars has the greatest canyon on in the solar system, and that's not too surprising because it has all this wind and the Earth does not. I told you it has the greatest mountains that we've ever seen and told you why that's not surprising. But here's something that really is incredible. Earth is supposed to be the planet whose geology is dominated by liquid water. And yet the greatest river valleys in the solar system are found on Mars. And here are four of the biggest. There is one, there is another, there is a third, and therefore fog can get a fourth. And each one of those valleys is so big that the current would have required 10 times the combined flow of all the rivers on all the Earth. Bones dry, every one of them. There is not so much as a drop of liquid water on most of Mars today, including these areas, but obviously in the past it has been very, very different. There are at least a dozen river valleys on Mars this big, and hundreds of others that are smaller. Perhaps you are not convinced by my claim that these are river valleys. Let me point out, by the way, just to orient you, this is the eastern end of Valles Marineris over there. There is some ground fog. And over here, you notice there is an area towards which all the river valleys seem to be flowing, if you'll accept my claim that they are. That is a low area. It is, in fact, a depression in the Great Lava Sheet, which covers so much of the Northern Hemisphere. Its boundary runs through like this. You can see there are lots of craters in there, but the boundary runs through like this. This is a depression called the Crissy Basin. And the Crissy Basin is a lowland, even for the Northern Hemisphere. It is 2 miles lower on the average in the rest of the Northern Hemisphere, which in turn is 2 miles lower on the average in the Southern Hemisphere. And so it was a place where there was especially high air pressure. That was one good reason the land Viking lander one there. And the other was they had hopes of sampling the deposits from these river valleys. And so now you know the reason for the landing site selection for lander one as well. All right. Some of these river valleys are very young. Some of them are quite old. How do we know this? Why? Because some of them are relatively uneroded and have very many meteorite craters in their bottoms, and some of them are very hard to see and are full of craters. And so what this means is, it's not just a matter that once upon a time Mars had a different climate than it does now, and now its air is lost into space or something like that. Oh no, nothing like that. Mars has apparently had at least a dozen separate episodes in the past when the very air was 2 to 3 times denser than it is now. In other words, there was 2 to 3 times as much of it as there is now. So that the pressure was high enough for liquid water to exist. And liquid water did flow, and it was warmer on Mars, because the more air you have, the warmer it's going to be. It was wetter, it was much more Earth-like, and each of those periods lasted for only a few thousand years, because the valley seemed to have done very little damage by erosion to the regions around them. There they are, they're very large, and yet they haven't developed regions around them where they destroyed these ancient craters, as you can see so well. And then, perhaps hundreds of millions of years later, there was another such episode, and between the episodes, somehow, most of Mars' air must have been stored. And how this could happen, how a planet can oscillate back and forth between two such radically different kinds of climate, has got to be the second greatest mystery of Mars after whether there's life there. Obviously, the first greatest, you know, is going to be whether there's life. But how this can happen? One possibility is this. We don't know why it should have been warmer, why it should have been colder in the past than Mars. All we can say is we've got exactly that same problem in trying to understand the Earth, why there are ice ages every few hundred million years. It's even possible they're correlated in time. If that were true, it would be a very, very exciting discovery. At the moment, we have no idea whether it's true or not. We don't have absolute ages for these things yet. We can say this one is young, this one is old. But how young, how old, we don't know. But in any case, the possibility exists that if you could warm up Mars somewhat, you might be able to evaporate some of that permafrost, which I showed you the evidence for existing. And so you'd be able to get large amounts of water vapor in the air. And in fact, it is quite reasonable, for reasons that I'll explain in the third lecture on the atmosphere, to believe that there should be more water vapor than carbon dioxide on Mars. And so if you could evaporate enough of that, you might get an atmosphere which exists of the present carbon dioxide atmosphere plus maybe 2 to 3 times as much made of water vapor. And it might then be possible for enough pressure to exist that some of that water vapor could finally liquefy, that the rains could come to Mars, and that you could have these great rivers. And then whatever mysterious thing that it was that made it a little bit warmer goes away. Maybe it was changes in Mars' orbit. We know Mars does go through cyclic changes in its orbit due to perturbations of other planets. Nothing disastrous. They balance themselves out over the long run. But over the short run, there are changes. And so it's possible that kind of thing happens. That kind of thing has been blamed with great success for trying to understand at least the details of the most recent ice age on Earth. It is also possible that the great volcanoes are related. Suppose you have a theory there's a lot of volcanic activity on Mars and lots of volcanic dust being ejected into the air. Well, maybe that could produce changes in temperature. We don't know. In any case, somehow it seems to have happened. Now, all of this you believe if you will swallow the thing that I'm trying to give you about how these are river valleys. Let me show you some of the evidence for it. There's the Christie Basin. This is the southeast of the Christie Basin. There's another set that runs in from the west. And here is a detail in that set that runs in from the west. There is absolutely no way that you could produce topography like that. Sandbars, deltas, intricate branching tributary systems, channels that get bigger downstream. There is no way you could produce that by lava, by wind, by glacial ice. The only possibility is large amounts of running water. The problem is that at least in the largest cases, the amount of running water required is staggering. There were, in fact, huge floods. Here's a place just to the right of that picture that I just showed you. This is the downstream end of those channels, and here, in fact, you're already beginning to see the lava of the Christie Basin. There is a ridge in that lava, the kind of thing that you frequently see in the lava areas on the moon. They're called mare ridges. And here's a place where so much water has apparently flooded in that that ridge, which by the way is not as high as it was, maybe a few hundred feet high and many miles wide, so if you were standing right on top of it, you probably wouldn't know it. Shadows in this picture exaggerated. But the ridge has been able to form a dam. Even though it's open, it flows in. Even though the water is flowing around, you can see clearly it flows in. Nevertheless, there was such huge amounts of water that apparently it ponded back behind that dam and pushed against the ridge with such force that eventually it found a weak place in the ridge and forced its way through the center here. And of course now all this is dry, so we've got something that nobody in a million years ever would have expected to see on Mars, a wind gap, just like the ones you have in the Appalachian Mountains on Earth. Well, we've seen the same sort of channels once only on our own planet. And that is in Washington State. In fact, it's out in the middle of the Columbia River Plateau, that great basalt sheet that I told you about earlier. This is a Landsat 1 image, false color infrared, which ends up making the really fertile areas of ground look red, and I won't go into the explanation about that. These are not the true colors, but you can certainly see the pattern. These are useful, but not real, the colors on a map, you know, if Michigan is green and Ohio is red and so forth. Same sort of thing here. The channels are one color and the farmlands are another, all right? The end of the scale, it's 115 miles from one side to the other there, the square. All right, these are channels, fully comparable in size to the ones that you've just seen on Mars, and these are the coulees. Everybody's heard about the Grand Coulee, which is this one over here. Well, coulee is the local name for these channels. These channels, which have been excavated into the solid rock of the Columbia River Plateau, which is not an easy rock to carve, were formed in the greatest flood of which there is any record in the geologic history of Earth, called the Spokane Flood, because it's studied especially well near that city. It happened 18,000 years ago, towards the close of the most recent glaciation. The retreating ice cap had uncovered part, but not all, of the Clark Fork, which despite its name is a major river out there, especially in those days when there was a lot of glacial meltwater flowing in it. And the Clark Fork was flowing in the direction towards the ice, and so the ice sheet acted as a dam, and in fact backed up a lake, which is called Lake Missoula because it extends all the way over into Montana, fully comparable in size to one of the smaller of the modern-day Great Lakes. That lake lasted for some thousands of years, and then one fine spring day, I would imagine, 18,000 years ago, the dam, which after all was made only of ice, failed, melted presumably, and the entire lake emptied over the surrounding countryside. If you imagine taking Lake Ontario and emptying it across New York State, you get the picture. That flood is estimated to have lasted for 3 days with a flow of 9 cubic miles per hour. And that is the 10 times the combined flow of all the rivers on all the Earth. Let me show you from a little bit further down what that flood did to the land. First of all, here's the evidence for Lake Missoula. This is an aerial photograph of Missoula, Montana. And here you see the shorelines, one after another of them, cut into the side of Sentinel Mountain by the various stages of Lake Missoula at various heights. And as high as Lake Missoula is almost 1,000 feet deep at this particular place. There is an aerial photograph of a detail in one of the channels. And this particular channel is 200 feet deep and 20 miles wide. There are places where each of those numbers can be multiplied by 3. The flood in 3 days, mind you, excavated these giant potholes, half a mile or more in size, in the floor of the channel, out of the solid rock of the Columbia River basalt. Here is a waterfall, Dry Falls in Grand Coulee. A little bit of water down there now, but not much. In fact, that's diverted by irrigation. Naturally, that would be dry. This is a waterfall, 5 times as wide as Niagara and 3 times as high, that was carved in 3 days by that flood. The flood did things like carry boulders the size of houses 50 miles downstream. We can prove that because you go upstream 50 miles before you find bedrock of the same type as the boulder. And perhaps the most impressive aspect to me of the flood was one of the details. Everybody's seen ripple marks in the bottom of the stream. Here are some fossilized in the sandstone, 125 million years old. And you can see from the tan and air for scale that they're, you know, how big a ripple mark is anyway, you know, maybe a quarter of an inch deep and maybe an inch or so from crest to crest, maybe not even that much. The Spokane flood produced ripples too, not in soft sand on the bottom of a creek, but in the solid rock of the Columbia River basalt. And those ripple marks are 200 feet deep, half a mile from crest to crest, and some of them 20 miles long. This kind of thing has happened on Mars repeatedly, not just once, but at least in a dozen separate locations across the face of the planet. I think you can see why they were so anxious to sample the deposits of those floods, and why they wanted Viking Lander 1 to land just off the mouth of one of the river channels. You see, you had a very fine problem here. If you land in the channels, you're going to be in those giant potholes. I'll get to this in a minute. If you land in the channel, you're going to be in those giant potholes, and you're going to destroy the spacecraft. On the other hand, if you're too far downstream, you're not going to have anything. The general rule, because you're going to be offshore, the general rule in geology is that a river bottom slopes less and less as you go downstream. Therefore, the flow is less and less. Therefore, the sizes of the particles that are carried become smaller and smaller, and the amount of the erosion that is possible becomes less and less. And so if you want to land on fine sand instead of house-sized boulders, what you do is go downstream. And if you think about a large river that you know, for example, the Mississippi, downstream you have the fine mud of the Delta, upstream you have lots of more active water, say up in Minnesota. So the idea was to try to land just at the right place within the stream. And the reason for the delays in the landing of Viking Lander 1 was that it turned out the Mariner 9 pictures had led us to believe the downstream end was a good deal further upstream than in fact it really turned out to be from the better Viking Orbiter 1 pictures. Before I go on to that, I just want to show you this picture, which is of one of the smaller channels actually, but each one of these channels tends to have at an upstream end a region like this. And these are called chaotic terrain, and in fact there were photographs all the way back in 1969 by Mariner 6, although nobody, it happened we got the chaotic terrain but not the channel, or else there would have been a great discovery even then. Nobody was to make of them, but even then some geologists noted that these look very much like the kinds of land, the kinds of terrain that you get in Arctic and Antarctic regions of the Earth where there has been large-scale melting of huge amounts of permafrost. For example, in Iceland, in a place where a volcano has suddenly come up through the permafrost. And so it appears as though at least the very largest of the flood channels, not the small ones, there are hundreds and hundreds of smaller ones, they don't have these, but at least the largest ones seem to have these places at their upstream end, and it looks as though there's been catastrophic melting of large amounts of permafrost, creating, releasing these gigantic amounts of water, which then flowed along, and apparently evaporated and sank into the ground as they went. I'll show you the evidence for that in a little while. What gives the sudden large-scale melting, we don't know, because as you can see, the ground has been pretty well thoroughly destroyed. Maybe with a meteorite impact, although it seems hard to believe that all the other meteorite impacts would have been the same thing. Maybe it was, in fact, volcanic activity. We don't know, but that's at least a hint. That's one of the pieces in the jigsaw puzzle. Okay, the evidence that they evaporated as they went is this is a little bit hard to see, but it's a Skylab image of a region around Great Salt Lake. And in fact, there is a portion of Great Salt Lake, and there's a Great Salt Lake. You may be aware that during the Ice Ages, there was a lake covering most of Utah, of which Great Salt Lake is simply the shrunken remnant. And in fact, these great flats, these alkali deposits, the famous Bonneville Salt Flats, are material with left over by the evaporation of Lake Bonneville, the name given to that lake. Well, that lake carved basins into the mountains, and you can see those even in the Skylab image. And from the ground, they are very impressive features. Here's what they look like in the picture that I took at about the same place as that one that I just showed you there. And each one of these is a shoreline, a wave-cut cliff that was cut by the lake as its waters rested at a particular level. The thing is that water is a very powerful erosion. If there had been a sea or even a temporary lake in the Kirby Basin, where all of those floodwaters were heading towards, we'd know about it from the Viking earlier pictures because we'd be able to see those benches. We'd be able to see these wave-cut cliffs. There is absolutely no evidence for them. And so apparently you have not only the incredible picture of these gigantic amounts of water being released in multiple places on Mars, amounts of water equal to the greatest flood that's ever been seen on Earth. In addition, you have the incredible picture of all of the water evaporating and flowing and disappearing into the ground as it flows, so that there is nothing left by the time it finally reaches the downstream end. But that is the evidence. Well, there are the potholes, and that was the place where they originally expected to land Viking Lander 1. You can imagine how horrified the geologists were when they got back these pictures. Well, the obvious thing was to look further downstream. And this is a little bit further downstream, and you can see what the floodwaters have done. There is a crater, and here is what is left of that crater's ejecta blanket, but you can see how it's been beautifully sculptured into the classic teardrop shape that is characteristic of fluid flow. That is the shape, the shape of an egg, for example, because that's the shape that flows most readily out of the hand, if you want to put it that way. And that is the shape that you get whenever there is some obstacle which is diverting a stream flow, and then the stream is diverted around and produces this kind of structure. As you go still further downstream, you get less intense sculpture. So you see, we're doing something right. The water did not flow as rapidly here. Therefore, it didn't do as much erosion. Still further downstream, the erosion is even less, though. As a matter of fact, these are believed to be ancient pre-flood, wind-eroded structures. And you see they're still allowed to remain to be visible here. We can still see them here. We couldn't see them further downstream or further upstream.